Okay, folks, we're going to go ahead and start this meeting. It is now 10 o'clock, and as anybody who knows me knows how much I'd like to start meetings on time. And I'm going to try to I'm going to try to admit people while I'm talking. So I do like to multitask. This is going to be a challenge, especially right now because oh, I know I can just hit the admit all button. Excellent. Okay. All right, so folks, let's go ahead and get started. I hope you know where you are. This is the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, and we he are here today in our monthly meeting that we do on Zoom. When I talk about we, it's not me and the mouse in my pocket, as they used to say, but it's me and Chance Urberstein, who is the president of our board of directors. There he is. And
Morning.
he's also, of course, a criminal defense attorney, a very good, effective, distinguished criminal defense attorney. So I'm so glad that he's here so I don't have to do all the talking. And besides which, of course, or in addition to, he has a lot of important things to say. So what we're going to do, how we're going to start this meeting out is the way we start out many of our meetings, so not all of them. And oh my goodness, I'm trying to figure the things I learned here. Welcome, Vicki. It's nice to see you, literally. She's here too. Great. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to have ask you to vote, and we don't have anybody who's like our admin person here who can do this. So I'm going to do my best to count votes. And if that fails, Chance and I are just going to go according to the agenda that we have created for the meeting. So the first topic that I'd like people to vote on, as far as would you like to hear about the SORNA regulations? If you would like to hear about the SORNA regulations, I ask that you go down to the bottom of the screen here, and under something, you're going to raise a reactions. Please raise your hand, which is different than a thumbs up. Or you can do either one. Okay, thumbs up or hand. Anybody who's interested in talking today about the SORNA regulations, Chance and I do have an update about what's been done, and of course we have other plans as well. So I'm seeing lots of hands. I just have to count them.
Lots of yellow hands out there. Okay.
Okay, I counted 23. Oops, that's on this
Somebody
page.
put up two. What is that? Who
There's
did
another page here, plus three, 26. Okay, 26. 26 hands that I counted. All right, so 26 people you have voted to listen to Chance and I talk about SORNA regulations. And also during that time, we will give you an opportunity to ask questions or make comments. The other topic we have here is indeed the ALI revised model penal code. So I think everybody just needs to lower their hands if you would be so kind. And so the model, just to remind you that the American Law Institute membership in June went ahead and voted overwhelmingly in support of a revised model penal code. And that penal code does, in fact, have some wonderful suggestions, and including that nobody should be on the registry for more than 15 years, and in fact, most people should be limited to 10 years. And also the fact that the registry should in fact be for law enforcement only. And it goes on and on. And by the way, too, it significantly limits the number of people, or sorry, the number of offenses that would require registration. It's a really, really great proposal, and I don't want to talk too much more about it. I just want to let you know that in fact, the ALI, again, their membership approved this in June of last year, and now the leadership of ALI is going vote on it this month. So if you're interested in hearing more about the ALI, please raise your hand. Do that by going to reactions and either raise your hand or give us a thumbs up if you would. So thumbs up, hands up if you want to hear more about the American Law Institute and their revised model penal code. Okay. Lots of hands. Keep going. We're going to give it another minute or two. Oh my gosh, somebody else is counting for me. The things I'm learning about this. This is awesome. Thank you. And I apologize, folks, but you know, in the beginning, Chance and I had somebody who was kind of like a monitor for us and did things like counting votes. And now we're on our own by choice. So that gentleman can actually earn a living on Saturdays. It's actually his busiest day. Okay, so I think we have 30 votes for ALI, which is even more than SORNA. Interesting. Let's move on then to the idea of the military veterans or military retirees who are, and if you could just lower your hand now, because now I'm asking people to vote on whether or not you're interested in talking about military retirees and they're being denied access to military bases. It's an issue that I understand doesn't have universal appeal, but I'm thinking that maybe even if you're not directly affected by this, this is something that you might have some compassion for. I mean, I myself do. I'm a veteran, but I'm not a retiree. But it seemed to me that, you know, that was one of the things that the military said in order to persuade people to spend a military 20 plus years in the military. It wasn't for me. One of those things, went there, got a t-shirt, that's enough, and stuff. So anyway, military retiree issue, 16 people have voted in favor of that. So let's move on to the next issue, which is a tiered registry law. And of course, it directly affects people in California, though I think some other people, and if you would please lower your hands if you've already voted on the prior issue. Or maybe people are voting on this one now. If you're interested in the tiered registry law, and Chance and I do have some updates about that, it's mostly good news. It seems to me like the courts are working out some of the bugs, the initial bugs, and including like, what the heck is this? Why would I care? what we're asking now, folks, if in fact you're interested in the issue of the tiered registry law in California, to please raise your hand or give us a thumbs up. So another couple minutes here, another minute rather, as I admit another guest. Okay, we're up to 20 votes on the tiered registry law. So the only topic that I have left here really is travel. And so during a pandemic, I don't know how important travel is to people. I have to say I'm staying close to home mostly. Though in October, when things were looking better, I got on an airplane. And flew to the East Coast. So, you know, we all have to make our own decisions. But the fact is that in addition to worrying about COVID and COVID restrictions, if you're on the registry, you also have to think about what the requirements are to go visit another state or to travel overseas. So far we've got 13, 14, 15. The number keeps increasing. No need for me to continue that number counting for you. But again, what Chance and I are ready to do is talk about travel, both domestic, which means inside the United States, as well as international. And I will say we have a bumper crowd today. So far, we have 95 people on the line today. I think that might be a record for a monthly meeting. Okay, so that's good. Okay, travel, we have 17 people. Whoops. I guess some people are starting to lower their hands. That's fine. Okay, so before we jump into any of these topics, there's a couple of things I'd like to say briefly to talk about. Let's say this again. This is the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. If you don't want to be here, this is a great time to leave, and so we won't hold it against you. But if you are here, please understand that the Alliance is here for you, whether you're on the registry or you have a loved one on the registry. We're here for you. We are a support team for you. And we've been around now for 10 years. Hard to believe it's been so long since Chance and I keep getting younger. But the fact is we have, in fact, been around for 10 years. And during that time, we've made a lot of progress. And I'm so happy to say in California, we've gotten rid of presence restrictions and residency restrictions and Halloween restrictions. And it's really made life for registrants in California more bearable. It's not perfect, I understand. And by the way, I need to qualify that. So for people who are not on parole, not on probation, not on supervised release, the shorthand is on paper, you're not on paper, then in California, there are no presence restrictions, there are no residency restrictions, and no Halloween restrictions. Having said that, I realize it's an expensive place to live. So not everybody's going to live. But anyway, we're trying to make it as comfortable as we can for our registrants. And of course, family members, because every time a registrant is told you can't live there, that usually means the family can't live there. Or, okay, the family can live there, but you have to live in your car somewhere else. And we just find that totally unacceptable. So the way that AXAL gets its work done, and that's, I refer to this organization sometimes as AXAL, sometimes as the Alliance. To me, it means the same thing. But the fact is, we have three pillars that we talk about, and they're education, legislation, and litigation. So those are really important because we know there's a tipping point out there somewhere. Someday society's going to wake up and go, oh my gosh, we made such a terrible mistake. How could we have done such a stupid thing? Think about Japanese people being, American citizens of Japanese descent being sent to internment camp. And by the way, when I was in law school, my roommate of 2 years, both of her parents went to internment camps because they were of Japanese descent, as was my roommate, quite frankly. Our country just goes stupid from time to time. And I'm afraid they've gone stupid when it comes to registrants right now. And someday I know that it's going to be better, but we just don't know how quite yet we're going to get there. So we want you to know we're here for you. In the meantime, we're going to be fighting these battles in the courts. We're fighting the battles in state legislatures. And we're doing what we need to do. We have an incremental approach. And I know not everybody agrees with an incremental approach, but it was good enough for a Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's good enough for me. And I think it actually makes a lot of sense because, you know, whenever a court really sticks its neck out and makes this really huge leap in the law, many times it gets overturned shortly thereafter because there wasn't a firm foundation for it to rest upon. So what we're trying to do is I kind of feel like I can't decide if I'm a termite or a beaver or something. But anyway, just chewing away at these stupid, unconscionable, unlawful laws, including some U.S. Supreme Court decision, of course, that needs to be overturned. And we're not going to get there in a day. And then I'm Italian, so I can say Rome wasn't built in a day. This problem is not going to go away in a day. But someday we're going to hit that tipping point. And you know what? We're going to have to get out of the way of the snowball that's coming down the mountain, right? That keeps getting bigger and bigger. And they're all of a sudden the same people who are now saying everybody on the sex offender registry is a monster. You know, they always do it again. There is no cure, blah, 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 blah. I think they're going to be jumping in front of our parade and going, oh, well, we knew that wasn't true. We just said it because we were afraid or because my neighbors believed it or because I read an article, you know, in the newspaper online one day. Okay, so we're just not there yet. So we're asking people to be patient and understand that we are here chipping away at a bunch of laws that are indeed unlawful. And we'll keep doing this until there aren't any laws left. I'm looking forward to putting myself out of a job, is another way to put it. Chance, you want to add anything right now?
Well, yeah, I'll say just briefly that, you know, that Janice, as well as Justice Ginsburg, the incremental approach is not new. I mean, you know, it's a winning approach. Let's just say, for instance, this weekend's football, greatest coach who ever coached, Coach Lombardi, said that the game is won in inches. And I remember coming to this meeting years ago. And the first thing I said was, when I got up was, we're only going to win by inches. It's just inches. And, you know, we've come a long way since we've started up. But, you know, in terms of community, in terms of culture, that is how the game is won. And, you know, what Janice says is really correct. You're not going to get it all in one swoop, but we're going to keep on chipping away. And eventually what seemed impossible is going to be possible. And then it's going to be gone. And I commit myself to doing just that. I know Janice does too. And with that, let's go forward.
All right. Thank you, Chance, for those good words. Okay, so the greatest number of votes was to the ALI revised model penal code. So we're going to start there. And two people have hands up right now, Eugene and Vainglorious One. If you would lower your hands, that would be helpful. Because otherwise we're asking people, if you have a question or if you have a comment, to go ahead and put your hand up. And you do that by going down to the bottom, reactions, in case you don't know yet. And there's a way there you can raise your hand. So, and I see a hand there, Mr. Llewellyn, do you want to have your hand up? Okay. Well, why don't we just call on you now? Do you have a question about, is it about SORNA regulations? I'm sorry, is it about the ALI rather? Okay, we can't hear you. The famous words of the pandemic. So I'm asking you to unmute, Mr. Llewellyn. There you go. Please.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me, yes. Janet?
Yes, we can. Okay.
Question. We've got FAC has a two lawsuits ex post facto right now. Are you in any way connected or helping and assisting Gail and company with that, or is this going to be a test case that maybe goes from there, or no?
No, and I'm sorry, but this has nothing to do with the ALI revised model penal code, so let's just leave it at that. That's a Florida lawsuit. I'm not licensed to practice in Florida, nor is Chance Oberstein. So that's it. Okay, we're going to talk about ALI now. So ALI stands for the American Law Institute. This is an organization that's been around for like 100 years or longer, and it has like the people with the best reputations as lawyers, as judges, some politicians I have them that are thrown in there as well. And it includes justices from state Supreme Courts. So not from the US Supreme Court, but from state Supreme Court. And by the way, the Attorney General of the United States of America, Merrick Garland, is actually a member of ALI. I don't think he's part of the their leadership, probably because of his current position. So the reason I'm telling you a little bit about ALI is I want you to know it's an organization that gets a lot of attention and respect from the legal community, but certainly also from legislators. So the organization realized that they had not made any recommendations to the model penal code in over 50 years, 50 years, okay? And they said, you know what? It's time for us to take a look at this. And so they did. And they spent 9 years looking at this, 9 years. So this is not a last minute decision. This is not an emotional response from somebody like sometimes happens with the legislature, right? Where some terrible thing happens and then they come and swoop in and fix it. They sometimes create other problems in fixing it. This is something that has gotten a lot of thought and a lot of attention. And in June of 2021, just last year, about 6 months ago, the members of ALI overwhelmingly approved a model penal code, a revised model penal code. And in that revision, there are some sweeping, and I do mean sweeping, provisions when it comes to people convicted of a sex offense. And I'll just mention a few in case you haven't ever heard of this revised model penal code before. One of them is nobody should spend more than 15 years on the registry. So 15 years, not lifetime. Remember, you hear that? Maximum 15 years, nobody would spend their lifetime on the registry. And by the way, most people would only have to be on the registry for 10 years. In addition to that, ALI's proposal is that the registry would be for law enforcement only. It would not apply, or it would not be available to the public, because quite frankly, as all of us know, the public doesn't know how to interpret the information on the Megan's Law websites. And I have plenty of examples, which I won't go into right now. And the third thing that this proposal would do, it does more than three things, but these to me are the three biggest things, it significantly reduces the number of offenses that would require registration in the first place. So this is really a big deal, okay? This is a big deal organization making a major, major recommendation. And by the way, they have the facts to back them up, okay? They've got the government reports, they've got the academic reports. They didn't just get out of, a dartboard or a Ouija board and say, wonder what we should do about this. They studied this. This is something that's been so necessary that somebody look at this with an objective mind. And they did look at it with an objective mind. And they came up with this wonderful revised model penal code. And by the way, to put it in context, as compared to California and our tiered registry law, I mean, we've been, well, Axol, ever since the tiered registry law was passed by the legislature in 2017, we've been trying to fix it, okay? If in fact this ALI model penal code gets adopted in California, we're not going to worry about the tiered registry anymore law anymore, because this is such a better fix than trying to put band-aids on the tiered registry law. And I believe that to be true for each and every state. So again, this is a big deal. Now, remember what I said? The members of ALI overwhelmingly approved this revised model penal code 6 months ago. But there's a final step, and that is their council, C-O-U-N-C-I-L, their council hasn't approved it yet. So between June of last year and now, unfortunately, a group of 37 attorneys general wrote a letter to ALI saying, we don't like this. In fact, we're asking you, the council, the leaders of ALI, to reject it, saying, even though your members overwhelmingly approved this revised model penal code, we want you to throw it out and put it in the trash. I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe there's somebody that does, you know, that knows ALI. I'm not a member of ALI. I have no insight into ALI. We do have a board member. Axol has a board member who is an ALI member, so she's not on the council of ALI. So she's looking at it from the bleachers, right, and wondering what those people are doing down there in the center of the field. So we don't know. At this point, we don't know what's going to happen. Chance, would you like to add something to that? I'm just saying.
Yeah, just to put it in proper context, the ALI are proposals and recommendations that can be either accepted or not accepted, adopted or not adopted by the jurisdictions, every jurisdiction, every state. It's a model for what the penal code should really be. You know, the penal code in the states as it exists now and in California is. The ALI is the ought. It ought to be that way. And so sometimes jurisdictions incorporate pieces of it. I'm not sure if any jurisdiction has ever incorporated all of it, but it is very influential. And it's you know, it's not just that maybe a jurisdiction will adopt it, but it's that it gives fuel for reformers who want to reform specific areas in that jurisdiction, specific criminal areas, let's say criminal reform for us, for our purposes. It really helps to have those recommendations, because those are the highest and best recommendations for how our penal code should be molded and reformed. And it gives us a lot of fuel to go to our legislators and to go to meetings with people who create policy for the state and push those recommendations so that it can be moved into law. So that's why it's so important to us. Janice?
Yeah, thank you, Chance. I want to repeat, because it's so important, part of what Chance just said. And that is, even if the ALI leaders adopt this revised model penal code later this month, then each and every state legislature has to decide whether or not to adopt it. Okay. And it may, in some states, I'm hoping California would be open to this. It turns out our governor already has a committee on revising a committee on revising the state's penal code. So it's not like we have to ask the governor in California to create such a committee. It already exists. So, but each and every legislature, you know, could make a decision again whether or not to adopt this. Many legislators are afraid. Okay. They're just so afraid that if they were to adopt something like this, that they might look like, oh, I'm a friend of sex offenders. And I hate to use that term, but I'm just going to use it because they use that term, right? And so they're like, oh, no, I don't want anybody to think I'm a friend of sex offenders. And so I'm not going to do anything that might help them. This is a big shield that they can hide behind. All right. It's a big, big shield. And so it's one of those things. It's kind of like when Chance and I go to court and we're representing somebody on the registry. No matter what the matter is, you know, there's a bias with the judge, right? And what we do with the judge is we give that judge tools to understand what is the current risk of this person, right? Things like a psychological evaluation by a PhD psychologist. You know, we give the judge a lot of tools so they will be able to understand that this person doesn't pose a current danger. So this is the time, folks, if you want to know anything more about the ALI, please raise your hand. Go to reactions on the bottom of the screen and raise your hand that way. I see one here. So I'm going to ask Freddie to unmute himself. Freddie, if you're ready, we're ready to listen to you. Freddie, are you there? Sometimes it takes a moment. This really is what everybody's going to remember about the pandemic, right? You're on mute. You need to unmute yourself.
There you go.
Okay, Freddie. Freddie, are you there? I heard a tone.
Radio silence.
All right, we've got two more hands up though. Daphne, I'm asking you to unmute yourself.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Okay. I was just wondering if you would recommend that we would write to our legislators about this at this point, or should we wait until it becomes final?
My strong recommendation is that you wait. I don't like to say wait to anybody, but in this case, I think it's a good idea to wait, and you don't have to wait that long. So the meeting, I don't remember if I mentioned the dates or not, it's January 20th and 21st of this month, right? So we're talking about less than 10 days from now. We will know, actually about a week from now, we will know whether or not the ALI leadership approved this. And because I'm really concerned with 37 attorneys general who've said, no, we think this should be rejected. You know, they're not the legislature, but they'll make it harder to get it passed in the state. And so I think we need the ALI leadership to approve this before we go forward. At least that's my recommendation to my board of directors here in California. It's a good question, Daphne. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Jim, I'm asking you to unmute yourself, please. Jim.
Yes, I had a similar question about senators and legislators, because they have their website and you can easily email them or send them a message of your situation. Like I said, I was on the registry for 20 years and it's been hard to get a place and work and, you know, to see how supportive they may be. And they send some kind of nice thing back. So I don't know if that helps to maybe influence some of these senators and legislators to for us. I don't know if that helps or not, for one thing. And is there a website for this ALI that shows a lot of this?
Well, you know what? On the Alliance website, we have an article about this. And if you go to this, you can search our website pretty easily. There's a box that says search. And if you just type in the initials ALI, an article will pop up. We put one on recently that basically announced this meeting on January 20th and January 21st. And so we've got information there. But I do think it's too early to approach any legislators yet. And by the way, the same article talks about the 37 states that where the AGs have opposed the revised model penal code. So it's you need to have that information before you go to your legislature. And folks, the way legislation works is you need to find a member of your legislature who will in fact be the author of the bill. So that's what it's going to require. There's going to have to be a bill that's written. There has to be an author of the bill that's written, right, that takes it forward. And when that happens, that's your strongest time. But I'm not saying you have to wait until there's a bill. You can, in fact, go meet with members of your legislature and just ask them. You know, tell them about the ALI proposed model revised penal code and say, this is what we think should be passed here in this state. And would you be the author of this bill? So, and by the way, just kind of lobbying 101, anytime that you're a constituent, the person who represents you in DC, the person who represents you in your state, they have to listen to you. You're a constituent. You've got the gold ticket. No matter what, they have to listen to you. You can go there and recite the Gettysburg Address. They have to listen to you. Now, they might not do what you ask them to do, but they have to listen to you. And it's amazing. Sometimes just opening a dialogue, what can happen.
Janice? Just to emphasize something you said, and it's really important though, wait until we find out exactly what the ALI is proposing, okay? Because, you know, there was an objection, there could be a revision. You don't want to put forward something you don't know. So make sure that, you know, before you decide to do anything with this concept, you know, make sure that, you know, we get the final on it so that we know exactly what it says. And then we can take from there. That's the most important thing. You can't, who knows what will happen between now and it gets published or whatever, if, you know, that's just a big if. But if it gets published the way we think it's going to get published, then it's going to be great. If it doesn't, well, then, you know, we're just going to have to see what's in it.
Yeah. I mean, that is one possibility. The leadership could say, look, we've gotten, you know, all these objections from 37 states. And because of that, we're going to basically make the committee redo that came up with the revised model penal code do it again. I don't know. Nobody knows. But we're going to get, I'm expecting to get an answer pretty in short order. So there is one person.
Is this under your NARSOL website?
No, sir. We are not NARSOL. We're AXOL. So thank you for that question. Our website is www.all4con, SO laws plural. So all four con, SO laws plural .org. Okay. And we will, and as Joe just said in the chat, we're a national organization with headquarters in California. It's very true, Joe. And Joe is actually one of our board members. So thank you, Joe, for that reminder. And so I hope somebody in the chat room will in fact put the full website address there, because we have all kinds of information, including about ALI. So I'm gonna, Jim, if you would please mute yourself. I think you are muted now. We have somebody who's been waiting, Vainglorious One. And I'm asking him to unmute himself, and I think he's the last person with a question or a comment.
Thank you, Janice. First, I want to thank you and Chance for standing up for reason and justice and for us. I wanted to ask, have you guys ever thought about taking an approach towards the American Disabilities Act, how these particular laws are like extremely difficult for people with mental disabilities, depression and such, which I kind of see it as more like bullying, because regular people can barely handle these. And then you're taking people who are already having serious, you know, psychological issues, and then they're putting this like a dump truck full of trash on us, you know, and which makes it like it really affects people's mental health. I was just wondering if that's an approach you guys have thought of, or if it's even possible to take.
You know, I haven't given it any thought, but I will give it thought now. And I will say, too, that if you think in the context of what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled way back in 2003 in that big mistake they made called Smith versus Doe, you know, they said it's not punishment to be on the registry. Huh. It's just like applying for membership at Costco. Well, actually, they said Price Club. What? That doesn't make any sense. That makes no sense. So I agree with you, and I'm happy to look into it. Thank you for that comment today.
Thank you, and God bless you guys.
Yeah, I will say that in the individual cases I take on, if there are problems like that, that certainly is weaved into what I do in these cases. So I've done it in individual cases. It may be something to consider in the future, as far as what we do as an organization. That's a good issue.
All right, we do have one other hand that's been raised since, and somebody is J.C. Sarna.
Also known as John S. I'm the one with the radio station in Arkansas.
Oh, excellent. Oh, I certainly recognize your voice.
Okay. This is the first time for me, and some of this may be the equivalent of preaching to the choir, but 3 points I'd like to get your feedback on in dealing with when the ALI comes out with its recommendations and how we in the states can build up an even better argument to get the ALI adopted. For one thing, specifically, dealing with the ALI, who do you see, who do you recommend as potential allies I'm thinking that it could be like the Public Defender Commission. Potentially, if there's any Prosecuting Attorneys Association. So in looking at the impact of the ALI, that's my first point. Who could be potential allies in the states? And secondly, well,
wait, stop, because I'd like to address that first, because it's a really good point. And I think Fertile Ground is looking at who submitted comments in favor of the revised model penal code within ALI. So, for example, I know the organization NACDL did, National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, lawyers rather, and so they, to me, would be a natural and national ally where we could reach out to NACDL, who in fact would know in all the states, and I think they do have in some states anyway lobbyists in those states. So I would think that would be a good example. Chance, you want to add anything before he goes to his next point?
No, that's an excellent place to start, because you know you can it's, they put themselves out there, so you know exactly which organizations support this, and you know where your natural allies are. So that's good.
The other, and this may be rehashing a lot of things, but specifically in trying to get the ALI adopted, we need to anticipate what the arguments against adoption are going to be. Are there any specific arguments that could be targeted in advance to where people who are supporting ALI have the answers, the rebuttals, the links, whatever is necessary?
Yes, that there is. And so we will prevail upon our board member, who is an ALI member, to share information with us. But I think they have, remember, this has been going on for 9 years. So, but especially like last June, or leading up to last June, when the members voted on it, there was quite a bit of, discussion, debate, fight about it. I don't know. My understanding from our board member is that there are actually, you know, so our position was the centrist position. Isn't that interesting? That there are people on one end that thought that JC just unmute. I just muted you. I'm asking you to unmute yourself now. Sorry. So there were some people who thought that the revised model penal code didn't go far enough, and other people who thought it went way too far. And it's kind of like anytime you have a situation, a compromise, I think that's a good place to be, right? If you have people on either extreme and then you're in the middle, I'm not used to in this issue being in the middle, quite frankly. And so I think I find it a real comfortable place to be. But anyway, I think that the ALI will share with us the background that we need. And then it's really up to us then and I to share it with others. And I promise to do that on the AXOL website. I think that was your second point of three.
Yes, yes. And the third and last one that I have, okay, here in this state and probably in a number of others, the legislators are usually willing to listen at least a little more to families of registrants, spouses, children, parents, and so on. Is that still, in a case like this, going to be a more effective route? Or should registrants themselves, ourselves, be prepared to come in and give testimony?
I agree with everything you said. And I want to tell you that in California, when we lobby in teams, and our teams include registrants, family members, and people like me who support registrants and family members, okay? Those are the kind of teams we put together, because we know each of those people has a different perspective. And you know, we also have a point paper, and we ask people to stick to the points on the point paper. But yes, of course. And the other thing is, folks, it can be dangerous. We're not telling you not to go lobby, but we're saying it's better if you can go lobby in a group. So when we, AXOL, go to lobby, we have a lobby day. And we, the organization, we put together the one-page point paper that you have to have. And it's not because legislators or their staff are stupid. It's because they're extremely busy. So you have to be able to distill your entire message on one page. And I know some people find that ridiculous and offensive and all those other things, but that's what's necessary. I'm a former congressional staffer myself, and I want to tell you that's how it works, right? Because I sat there and I had meeting after meeting every single day, and people wanted to come in and say this thing, that thing, or the other thing, but I didn't have time to look at a 25 page manifesto or a 50 or 100 page manifesto. I had time to look at one piece of paper. Now, if you have an effective one page, you know, point paper, then the person says, I am interested in this point on your point paper. Can you get me additional information? Okay. That is when you know you've had a good meeting, when they ask you for more information. But again, I promise that this organization will provide people with arguments in favor of the revised model penal code, and then also prepare you for what the arguments, at least so far, have been against it.
And also, just to pinpoint on that last question, you know, about, you know, what's the most effective way to do this? You know, legislators are sensitive to victims, and whenever they hear victim, the name, you know, just the buzzword itself, you know, piques their interest. But, you know, the collateral effect of registration creates victims of families, of children, of friends, all kinds of stuff. But initially, a person's family and their children. And, you know, that's an issue that stems directly from registration and the registry. And I think that co-balances, you know, the public safety type of issues. So I think it's important not just that registrants do it, but that their support systems do it as well, because collaterally, especially their families are impacted by this. And so it's just really important to get everybody involved. So that's my take on this.
Absolutely. I agree. All right. So we don't have any more hands up on this issue about the ALI revised model penal code. So we're going to move on. But before we do that, and the next topic is going to be SORNA regulations. But before we do that, it's time for commercial. And what I mean by that, I want people to have put on your calendar March 2023. It's only 14 months from now, okay? We need you to start thinking about how you're going to get to Washington, D.C. in March of 2023. We're going to have a major event in 2023. Thank you, Vicki. She's holding up her countdown calendar. So we have such a thing as to tell us how many days, weeks, months, I'm sorry, and minutes before our event happens. So let me tell you a little bit more about it. On March 4th, 5th, and 6th of 2023, not this year, next year, we're going to have a conference. And Vicki Henry from WAR is in charge of the conference, okay? March 4, 5, and 6. It's a Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And during that conference, you will be trained of how to become an effective lobbyist. And you will be, and there's Cliff in his calendar. Thank you, Cliff. Countdown calendar. So you will be trained to become an effective lobbyist in Washington, D.C. You will have an opportunity on that Monday, which is March 6th, to go meet in an office, a legislative office in Washington, D.C. We're going to set up as many meetings in advance as we can. And when we don't, we're going to just walk into people's offices, and especially where you're a constituent. And then the big event, the big public event, is on Tuesday, March 7th. Please come to Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, March 7th. If you can't make it to the conference, at least come on Tuesday, March 7th. Why is it on a Tuesday? Because we need people lobbying on Monday. We need to tell the legislative offices about our event on Tuesday and invite those legislators and their staff to come join us, right? We need some folks here to support what we're doing on March 7th. What is this all about? It's all about March 7th. Is all about informing, educating the U.S. Supreme Court about what a stupid decision they made and how much it has harmed a huge amount of people in our country. I know. I listen to people every single day. I listen to registrants. I listen to family members. I listen to attorneys and psychologists you know, who support them. Folks, we know what's going on. And we also know that what the U.S. Supreme Court said in 2003 is wrong. Do I want to call it a lie? Probably not, just because they relied upon some information that was incorrect. And when Ira Ellman and his wife, Tara, boiled it down to what was it that the U.S. Supreme Court relied upon? And do you know it was an article in a magazine that they relied upon? The U.S. Supreme Court? What? And that magazine is Psychology Today. I don't held it in high respect at any time, but my goodness, why would the U.S. Supreme Court be relying upon a magazine article? And in this magazine article, there is one unsubstantiated remark made by one individual that the recidivism rate for people on the sex offender registry was frightening and high. I think he said 80%, right? And that's not true. That was in 2003. We've been struggling so long to say, U.S. Supreme Court, you need to understand that's not the facts. Oh, here are the facts. Here is a U.S. government study that says it's 5.3%. Okay, 5.3%, not 80%. Here's a California Department of Justice, Department of Corrections study that says while you're on a parole, the rate of reoffense is less than 1%. It's not 80%. It's not frightening and high. So U.S. Supreme Court, you made a mistake. We're telling you, you've made a mistake. We've tried other ways to tell them, by the way, and they won't listen. They won't take a case so far, right? So, okay, there's another way to do it. We're going to walk to their doorstep, to their door. We're going to be standing on their steps. And we don't think we can be ignored. And I think that we're going to get a lot of publicity, national publicity, and also international publicity. And it's time for the U.S. Supreme Court to understand the magnitude of the mistake that they've made. And by the way, we're also going to be educating the public at the same time. So other than that, I don't care about this. Sorry to get so adamant here, but again, March 7 is a vigil, and then there's 2.5 days of a conference before that. You're going to learn so much. We're going to inspire you. You're going to feel empowered by the time it's over. So please mark it on your calendar. We understand for some people like us in California, Washington, D.C. is really far away. And so it's time to start planning what resources you're going to need to get there. Come join us. Okay, we have a couple hands up here, but I don't know if your hands are up about this event or about SORNA. So why don't we chance to start on SORNA, and then we'll call these people. But before I do that, Vicki, I want to ask you to unmute yourself, because Vicki, I mentioned her before. She is the head of Women Against Registry. So I'm clicking on, there you go. And also she's going to be head of the conference that we're just talking about in March 2023. What would you like to add about that?
Well, we have started planning. We've started gathering our advisory committee, who will not be part of any of the organizations, but will be advising us specifically regarding Washington and the politics there. So we encourage people. I know one person that opened a savings account and has already saved $8,000 planning to be there. So that's why Janice and company gave you such a time to plan on that. And we will be having a meeting. We will have our war room meeting on the 25th of this month, and Janice and I will be talking about it more and sharing about the committees. So if you're interested in being involved and committed to be involved, we invite you to be on that call on the 25th.
Thank you, Vicki. Mm-hmm. Yeah, more details then. Okay, so let's talk about SORNA regulations. This is just such a complex topic, and Chance and I are going to do our best to start a discussion about it. And certainly we want your questions and your comments as well. So when it comes to the SORNA regulations, they became effective last week, right, on January 7. And so, about 10 days ago, they came into effect. I don't know about how you all felt, but I felt like I got punched in the gut about this. So the SORNA regulations are terrible. We tried to stop them and we were unable to stop them. And so we have to challenge them. And we're trying as an organization, a two-prong approach. That's how many prongs we have so far. The first prong, and in fact, has already been exercised, is to file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Inspector General. So these are the folks who are supposedly care about waste, fraud, and abuse. And when we thought about it, we went, wait a minute. This, you know, these regulations are going to cause federal, state, local governments, right? All three to spend a whole lot of money that achieves virtually nothing. So why is it that they need to know what boat you own? Why is it that they need to know your remote identifiers? My God. And some of this is, what does it even mean, a remote communication identifier? I'm not sure what that means. That was one of the comments we made. So don't know what's going to happen with this complaint to the IG's office. But as a former federal government attorney, I will tell you, they always preach to us that, oh my God, you know, heaven forbid that we use an extra paperclip, right? Or three pieces of paper, because that could be fraud, waste, or abuse. But how about something like this, where basically the Department of Justice is just, you know, queuing up this huge waste of resources. Money certainly is part of it. And, you know, if I could put in there, and I know like the one person that we had speaking earlier, and he talked about the emotional, you know, impact of the registry upon him and upon so many other people, whether you're on the registry or not, by the way, the family members, of course, also have this experience, this impact. Well, the fact is that, you know, let's go meet them where they are. If the federal government, are not supposed to commit fraud, waste, and abuse, and here they just open the floodgates to fraud, waste, and abuse, well, this needs to be answered. Now, what do we hope to get from this? The best case scenario is they basically decide that the regulations should not be effective while this gets investigated. Do I think that's going to happen? Don't know. But at least it's worth a try. I was able to file this complaint online. I followed up with a written complaint and supporting documents. Okay, so they have the documents now. They should know better. They should, you know, it's like we're educating the U.S. Supreme Court in March of 2023. Well, we're educating the Inspector General's office at the DOJ in Washington, D.C. already. We're not waiting for 2023. Okay, so in addition to this, there will be litigation. We are actually talking to another nonprofit that is interested in joining us. And this is like awesome. They are much larger than we are. They have considerably more resources than we do. And it's very promising. By the way, they came and tapped us on the shoulder and said, you know what? We think this is wrong. Would you mind if we filed a lawsuit about this? And we said, we would love you to file a lawsuit about this. So their final decision isn't made yet. It's gotten up to the mid-management level and they did approve it. And we have one more layer to go. So, and by the way, if that organization does not file a lawsuit, we will. And even if they do file a lawsuit, we may file a lawsuit in a different jurisdiction. So it's, there's, you know, we don't want to compete with whatever lawsuit they might file, but we might want to complement it by filing a similar lawsuit in another jurisdiction. So, Chance, what would you like to say about SORNA regulations?
Well, yeah, they're unjust, they're unconstitutional, they're flat out wrong is what I'd like to say about them. But you know, I think you've covered it pretty well. These regulations that we're concerned with are rules that that are generated as part of the overall statute. The concern of ours, what set off the red light alarm, was that rather than being directed to the states that have already complied with and are operating under SORNA, they're directed to registrants as individuals, which has crossed the line for us. And that is, and that is where we're at. Again, they're wrong. There is no federal registry. And it just seems another layer of stuff that has to be worried about in terms of the gray areas. And so when you have that, you have unpredictability. And therefore, it has everybody kind of frozen in place because they don't know what to do. And this is an awful situation. So we are steadily approaching how to address it properly, what to do. We've taken some action. We've not only, you know, Janice has not only filed a complaint, but when the the rules first came out, we studied them as a group, as a brain trust, and we made recommendations anticipating potential litigation in the future, of course, and I think those were discarded, and that was foolish. So I think here we are. With that in mind, maybe we should take some questions, Janice.
Good idea, Chance. We have three hands up so far. Gregory, I'm going to ask you to unmute here. And sir, do you have a question or comment about the SORNA regulations?
I'm technically not part of any child convictions, although the state of California has me listed as someone who may have been involved with a conviction that could have been children, but the federal, when you do the live check on me, the federal shows that I'm not. And I'm afraid to travel to Mexico at this point. And what would I have to do to safely be able to leave the country now as someone without anything to do with children?
And are you talking about leaving the country temporarily or permanently?
I'm talking about, I'd like to go for 5 days to Mexico. And it's my understanding that I to protect myself, I have to go and inform people 21 days ahead of time that I'm leaving the country.
Well, you've really asked a question about travel. Chance, why don't you go ahead and answer it briefly, and then I'm encouraging people right now to make question or comments or ask questions about SORNA, which is not really about travel. But go ahead, Chance, if you would.
That's true. That's about international travel and IML. But I know Mr. Callahan, Mr. Callahan can call me. I think individually we can talk about this better without disclosing facts that need to be looked at as part of the analysis. So I'd encourage you to give me a call.
Sure. And folks, from time to time, Chance or I are going to make that comment to you. This is a recorded meeting, folks. And we do our best to protect our recordings, but we put a link to the recording on our website, and that website is available to the public. So it's up to you how much you want to reveal about your identity. I see many people have a first name and we don't see their face. That's perfectly fine with us, by the way. You have the right to do that. When we used to have meetings in person, I would say things like, when you come up, you know, if you have a question or a comment, you know, stand up, please, so we can hear you, and then tell us a name. Doesn't have to be your real name. I only ask we don't have too many Mickey Mouses or Donald Ducks at the same meeting. So anyway, I guess maybe we should say Bart Simpson too. Anyway, let's go ahead. The next hand up is from David. So David, there you go. Welcome.
Good morning, Janice and Sam. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Excellent. Just a quick question about the complaint that was filed regarding the new SORNA. Would it be of any benefit for us individuals to also send complaints? That's my only question. Thank you. I'll go offline for it.
Okay. Thanks for your question, David. I don't think so. This is one of those things that I'll reserve my comment for today. I might change my opinion in the future, but I don't think them getting a whole lot of complaints is going to make a difference. I mean, as it is, my one complaint, maybe they'll push it to the side. I did say I was making the complaint on behalf of the organization, and we have, you know, almost a million people on the registry these days. So maybe that'll make a difference and maybe it won't, but at this point in time, I think not. All right, next question or comment is from Michael, and asking you to unmute, sir. Welcome.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. I was wondering if doing anything in international courts would be effective, like the UN or anything like that with regard to SORNA.
With regard to SORNA, Are you involved right now with anything international? Because I know that there's a group out there, and I'm just trying to, is like the Human Rights, International Human Rights Organization. the name is escaping me.
There's an organization in Germany that is putting some stuff together. I'm also working with a guy through my work with Before You Act that is trying to put together an international organization similar to WAR. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's fertile ground. And, you know, if you want to approach me sometime, not during a meeting that's being recorded, I think we might have some more things to talk about.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you.
And thank you, sir. All right, Marty. You have something to say about SORNA?
Yeah, well, obviously we have some new conditions that we have to follow. And my question, and I'm sure this is something that a lot of people are thinking about, is do we automatically just start registering every single quarter as per the SORNA regulations and providing all that information to our local offices? Or are we waiting for them to notify us first? Because obviously we all want to be in compliance.
Sure. Well, I have a quick answer to your question. The first question, no, you don't have to start complying with the SORNA regulations. And yes, my recommendation is you wait until the government notifies you about a change in circumstances. So I'm watching very carefully what's happening to people who have registered here in California, but I'm willing to listen or read your registration documents as well if you're from another state, and would be interested in doing that. And because I wanted to know, are any SORNA regulations creeping into the annual registration document? So far, but we're only 2 weeks into the year. So far, the answer is no. So far. But I think that is one way that the government could notify you is when you go in for your annual registration. So I recently wrote one of my Janice's Journal column, my latest one, by the way. And in that I said something, I'm going to repeat it here, to keep calm and carry on. Okay. So this is not a time to panic. We don't like the SORNA regulations. They're vague. They have a chilling effect on people's lives, but please don't panic. The really important thing is just to do what you've been doing, and that know that unless you are notified by the government, not by this organization, not by your neighbor, not by if you're going to counseling, your counseling group, that doesn't count. The government has to notify you that the restrictions have changed, because otherwise, like in California, most people in our state, they only register once a year. So what's going to happen when you go in? Let's just say your birthday's in January, like Frank Lindsay, who I always like to pick on. Anyway, and then he goes in April to register again. What do you think his registration officer is going to say? Why are you here? Get out of my office, right? And local, I mean, the SORNA regulations didn't come with a bundle of cash for state governments or for local governments, either one, right? So this really is an unfunded mandate, which, by the way, is supposed to be unlawful when the federal government tells states and local governments to do things and don't give them and doesn't give them money. So that's one of our arguments, by the way. We'll see if it sticks. Chance, do you want to say anything there?
Yeah, just, you know, comply with state and local ordinances. That's what you do until you're otherwise noticed to do something else. And if you are, contact us immediately. It would be nice if we could, you know, even now, Janice, I think, if we just took a poll to see how many people on this call, we've got roughly 100 people, how many people have been noticed to comply with these new rules and regulations? I'd be interested to know.
Okay, well, let's ask that question now. So going down to reactions, I think that, how about if you give us a thumbs up, which actually, give us a thumbs up if in fact you have been provided any government notice. Remember, notice by the government, not by us, not by any other support group, not by any other organizations, like nonprofits and stuff. See, and so absolutely nobody is giving us any indication that they've gotten any notice. So we shall see. I mean, they only went to effect on January 7th. So it's been less than 10 days. You know, Are they going to creep up some way, bubble up? It's kind of like, what is it like? Glenn Close and Fatal Attraction. Anyway, jumping out of the bathtub. I don't know what to compare it to. It's just awful. So we hope that if, in fact, they do take effect, that it's going to be a long time from now. And I say that because that will give us time to litigate. Right. So we're not just sitting on our hands doing nothing. We're going to go litigate as soon as we can get our a really solid claim together. And because we can't do this halfway, we have to, when you jump into this, you jump into it all the way. And it does take some thought. And trust me, as Chance said before, we had a brain trust. When the proposed regulations came out in August of 2020, we came to a group of lawyers, legal professionals came together, and we thought then, and we submitted a comment that I think is over 35 pages long, full of legal arguments and everything. These regulations are fundamentally flawed, and nobody should have to comply with them. Nobody. That's just my opinion. Okay.
Yes. Janice, may I say one other thing real quickly, please?
Really?
Okay. Well, obviously, in performing litigation regarding the SORNA regulations or anything else, you need litigants. And I have been a litigant in a number of these lawsuits, and my hand is raised for this one especially and any others. Again, Janice and Chance cannot do this without us. So if you want to, and I'm sure everybody wants to, and I'm sure everybody's a little bit fearful of it, reprisal. I haven't had any reprisals for standing up for my rights with, Janice
Marty, unfortunately, we can't hear you.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
All right. That better?
Yeah, that is better.
Oh, sorry about that. I know I rambled a little bit. No, what I'm saying is, Janice and Chance, attorneys, in order to battle these regulations and other unjust laws, they need litigants. They need people to stand up. And I've done so a couple of times, and I'm more than happy to do it again for this one especially. And I know it's a little bit scary. I know there's a fear of reprisal, but you know what? Nobody's going to be coming after you if you stand up as a litigant in these lawsuits. Please, please offer up that service to Janice. It doesn't hurt, I promise you. And when we knock down certain laws that are totally unconstitutional and unjust, there is such an amazing feeling of accomplishment afterwards. And you know what? We're all helping ourselves, and we're all helping a lot of other people as well.
Yeah, thank you, Marty, for that.
Yeah,
and thank you. So Marty mentioned plaintiffs. I'm going to mention another one: dollars. Just be really bold here. We need donations, folks. Everything we do is based on private donations. So please, if you can contribute to the organization, it's really easy to do it on our website. There's a donate button, goes to PayPal. It's so simple for both parties. Please do it that way, or you can always mail us a check. 1215 K Street, K like the letter K, comma 17th floor. It's in Sacramento, and the zip code is 95814. So if you want to send us a check in versus snail mail, I don't think we are to the point where we can accept, what is that? I'm not even going to mention it. Anyway, let's just do it the old-fashioned way. You can either basically use PayPal, our donate button, or you can mail us a check. Okay, Woof, you're ready to ask a question or make a comment about SORNA. Is that correct? Sir, we can't hear you. You
got to unmute yourself.
Okay, there we go. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. Hi, Janice. This is I try to keep on taking off my boss's his label. This is Alfred DeLeo.
Oh, hi.
Chance and I had a briefly on international. Chance and I had a long couple weeks ago after the last meeting, a long talk about Italy because it's both of our interests. And let me just let people know there are 27 countries in the European Union. Most of them actually have a privacy right where if something happens, they wouldn't say the name, they'd enforce things. Italy is trying to come up with a registration. They technically have one. Ireland, basically UK, Ireland, and Scotland, and a couple others are testing it. But they do have a lot of the countries have a big ex post facto protection, okay, an identity protection also. So In my case, I'm actually an Italian citizen, and I've been trying to get over there just to get my paperwork done for my passport.
Okay, stop. Please stop.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
This is not about SORNA. It's about travel.
Oh, no, sorry, travel. Sorry about that. All right. So the thing is that...
I'm going to mute you because we're going to talk about travel later. I'm sorry. Okay, Chris, I'm going to ask you to mute yourself. If you have a question about SORNA, but only SORNA, or you have a comment about it, folks, we have to be judicious. We have to be focused here. Keep everybody focused. This is about SORNA now. Chris, do you have a question or comment about SORNA?
Yes, I'm actually in Nebraska, which prior to even the new regulations, looked into and was given permission to be a SORNA regulated state. So I already, prior to even the new regulations taking effect, when I moved here in February of 2021, I was already required per Nebraska law to register every 3 months based on the date of my birth, based on the month of my birth. That comes up for me again in March. So if you guys want, when I re-register in March, I can let you guys know in Nebraska, if who's already a SORNA state, if they've added any of the new additional requirements.
Thank you, Chris. That would be very valuable. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure, not a problem.
All right. Moving on to Kim. Kim, you've had your hand up for a while.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Please pardon my ignorance. I'm fairly new to this, but I did read that document. Is this a done deal, or is this a regulation that has to be go before our lawmakers to ratify it?
Kim, it's a done deal. They became effective on January 7th.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, David, you're next.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, fantastic. Again, thank you folks for everything you do. It's fantastic. I just had a quick comment to add to what you had said, or just to reiterate what you said. Please, folks who are listening, if you receive any notification regarding SORNA, please immediately get in touch with Axel and let them know. Whatever state you're in, please let Axel know what's happening. But my second comment is just a challenge to everyone to please make a donation. I'm going to make a $25 donation today. I will be sending that out immediately. And folks, I make a donation every month to Axel. I just have it in my bill payer as an automatic payment. Process each month. So please, everyone, think about that. It would be a huge help if Axel is able to know how much income they're going to have every month. So thank you, everyone. Please, please, please donate. Thank you.
And thank you, David, for that public service announcement on behalf of the Alliance.
Thank you, David. And also, you know, just again, Janice said it and David said it, and I'll say it too. You've got the best advocates in the whole world here. And it can't function without your support. So, you know, please help us do these things we need to do for you and for everyone. Donate and donate and donate until we just cannot be stopped, you know, not by any constraint, including financial constraints. Help us do this thing. So we appreciate your support. We appreciate your donations, but please, please help us. Help us go forward with these things. Thank you.
And thank you, Chance. And let me give you an example. We have a person who donated $10,000 and donated to a law school in Los Angeles. And because of that donation, we have a law student who was able to do some basic legal research. And that took a little bit less than $2,000 of that. And, you know, she gets paid a very small amount of money. and anyway, she did some fabulous research for us in that. And we were able to do it through the law school because that it made sense to that person to donate to the law school, you know, because for tax reasons and everything. We have a foundation, by the way. You can also donate to the foundation, and similar things can be done. But and you know, you can use your imagination about that. Okay, so the next three topics we've got are military veterans, the tiered registry law, and domestic and international travel. And I'm going to use my prerogative here and delay tiered registry law, even though it should be next in line, because there are people mostly in California who are focused on that. So let's go ahead and move on to military veterans and retirees. And so, Chris, if you put your hand down, that would be great. And if there are folks out there who care about this issue about military retirees, this is the time to put your hand up if you have a question or a comment. So real briefly, I was contacted in early November by someone who said, you know, I'm a military retiree. I go to the base for my medical care, to the commissary, to the base exchange and other reasons. And I've been doing that for decades. And all of a sudden I was denied access to the base with no notice given. And I thought, well, that's unusual. And that happened here in California. And so I told a friend of mine whose husband is on the registry and is a retiree that had just happened. And if that should happen to her husband, let us know. Well, didn't have to wait long. I think it was 2 days later. She contacted me and said it happened to her husband as well. Again, in California. One was an Air Force base, by the way, the other was a Navy base. So it's like, okay, how big is this problem? So then we put an article on our website, and my goodness, asking for people to contact me and let me know if indeed they had a situation like that happen to them. And I will tell you, I have been practically flooded by calls, emails, text messages, et cetera, even written letters telling me about their experiences. And folks, we're talking about people who spent 20 years or longer in the military, who almost always, they were convicted of a sex offense after they left the military. And now, so many years later, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Army are all of a sudden telling registrants, you can't come on base. And I've looked at the military document from the Marine Corps, and it just flat out says, if you're on a sex offender registry, you are denied base access. That's it. You're just denied base access. Well, and by the way, it's not just in California, it's all over the country. So people all over the country right now are being denied, these military retirees denied access to bases for almost every reason. And I was able this past week to get relief for one person who is a cancer patient. He was getting treatment at Naval Balboa Hospital in San Diego. And all of a sudden, he was told he couldn't get on the base, so he couldn't go have his cancer treatment. Fortunately, I found a Navy official who has a heart and compassion and said, well, that's not right. And she was able to get him access. Now, how long would that access last and everything other thing? But we're talking about, I don't know how many people, I'm saying thousands, it might be hundreds of thousands of people, again, who are on the registry and who are military retiree or would otherwise have the right to go onto a base for any reason. So I want you to know that another attorney and I, if you all know Paul Dubling in North Carolina, he and I and my legal assistant are working, the three of us, to try to figure out how we're going to challenge this in court. Okay, so we just can't let this stand. It's a slippery slope for folks. And let me tell you, it's already happened to people on the registry who are military retirees. They've already been told you can't be buried in a military cemetery. And I'm like, what? You're afraid that they're going to, this corpse, you know, the skeletal hand is going to come out of the ground and grab a child's ankle and pull him to the ground? I mean, how freaking ridiculous is that? But that's the kind of stuff that has already happened. And now this is happening. And again, without notice. So I know somebody, two people now are waiting to be heard. So I don't remember which one that was first, but Eric, I think you're first. So I'm going to call on you, sir, if you'd unmute yourself. If you have a question or a comment about this issue.
Yeah,
I actually did not know this was in effect. I heard Michael from Narsal talk about it a few months ago, but I thought that was an isolated incident. And I just have on my calendar in 2 weeks, I've got to go on base at Fort Leonard Wood to get my military retired ID renewed. Mm-hmm. It's going to expire. And I use that all the time. And you have to go on base. That's the only place you can get the ID. So now I can't get my renewed military ID, which I need for the VA amongst all other kind of things. That might be an argument, you know, you could have in fighting the case. So.
Okay, well, I appreciate your sharing that with us, Eric. And I'm not saying it will happen to you, but it's happening to a lot of people. And by the way, the document that I saw, it's from the Marine Corps, and it was dated May of 2021. And it said it was going to affect on November 1 of 2021. The person who contacted me, he had the bad fortune, the misfortune of going like 2 days later, I think it was November 3rd, and basically denied base access. By the way, to go to on that base for medical purposes. And it's just wrong. So there's, in reading the cases that are out there, it's not going to be an easy case to win. Believe it or not.
Right.
And I'm like, what? And what I'm really concerned about too, folks, and I would hope that you would be concerned about too, is what's going to happen next, right? If the right to come on base for all these reasons is going to be taken away, and by the way, without any notice, and this is what most of the retirees are worrying about that I've spoken to or that communicated me in one way or the other, is what's coming next? Are they going to take my retirement pay? Right? But remember, the U.S. Supreme Court tells you you're not being punished. So we're not going to let you go into a military base for medical care, but that's not punishment. Sarcasm. All right. So, Michael, you've been waiting to speak, ask a question, or make a comment. Please, is this regarding the military issue?
Yes. I just finished my military retirement in Jefferson City. I didn't have any problem getting on base. But I did notice on the paperwork for the burial, yes. I believe it said you had to be tier 3.
Oh, good. Okay, it's not so, everybody.
I mean, and I could scan and send that. I'd probably send it to Vicki and let her forward it. I mean, if you're interested. But, yes. My concern, though, is like you said, I think this is a stepping stone for things to get worse. And
so you're worried that they're going to come after your pension, right?
Well, I mean, that's always a possibility. I just don't know what they're going to come after, but after 20 some years on the registry, you know, I've seen things escalate and,
yes,
you know, it's just, I don't know what's coming next kind of situation.
Sure.
But
well, I think you have a valid concern there. What is coming next? As I said, it's a slippery slope. So they told you some people can't be buried in the military cemetery. They're now telling people you can't join the military if you're on a sex offender registry. And now if you're on a sex offender registry, you can't come on a military base, even if you're a retiree and gave more than 20 years, you know, to your country. All right, Michael. Well, thank you for your comment today. I'm going to move on to Bill. Bill, please unmute yourself.
Yeah, I think I'm unmuted. Are we good?
Yes, we can hear you.
All right. I'll just try to make this quick. At least from an Air Force perspective, I have some history on this, and I will send you some contact information after this. So you can speak with me separately if need be. But at least in the Air Force, and I suspect the rest of DOD, these basic rules about not being able to access a base if you're on a registry, those have been in place for quite some time, at least 10 years. What has recently changed, however, and what has always been kind of the workaround was that the ID cards have a little barcode on the back. And when they scan those going through the base, it says, okay, yep, you're good. You're authorized. Everything's cool. Go on. As of November 1st, now that information that's tied to the ID card back in the database is now pulling from, all the various databases with regards to sex offenses. So now tied to your social security number, anybody and everybody who's got a sex offense or any other reason to not be allowed on a base, that now gets flagged easily by the person who's scanning that ID as you move through the gate. So that's kind of what that major change has been here as of 1 November. Now, the additional point of that is the method for getting permission to access the base, even with those restrictions, has been in place for all those years as well. The problem becomes one is that it's on a base by base basis. So yes. the base commander at, you know, Bowling Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. may approve you to come on Bowling. But then you go 5 miles away and try to get on Andrews, you would not be able to do so unless you got a similar permission from the base commander at Andrews. And you have to repeat that at every other military installation that you would like to gain access to. So that's a serious issue. Even if all the restrictions stay in place, once you've gained approval in one place, it would be significantly convenient if you had approval everywhere else as well.
I understand what you're saying, Bill, and you have a very valid point, because I and some of the people who contacted me who say, you know what, I live in this town or this city, but when I travel, I often go to, you know, a military base that's nearby for supplies, sometimes for housing, you know, even like kind of vacation housing. I mean, all of these different things. And again, you know, to be just for this to be stripped away from you without notice, I mean, it's really a due process violation. So that's certainly one of the things that we're looking at. And I thank you for that comment. Laura has been waiting to speak to us either with a comment or a question about military retirees, I hope. Laura?
Hi, Janice. Yes. So my spouse is currently incarcerated, and the VA rep that is going to the prison is telling them point blank that they will have housing and none of their benefits will be taken away, which of course is not the case.
So you, let me just make sure I understand you, that your husband who's currently in custody is being told by a VA representative that when, after he's released from custody, he will have his full benefits?
Yeah, full benefits. Now, he is not a retiree, but he will not be lost any of his medical, and he will be allowed housing regardless of the offense. So obviously, that may not be true. Now, when he was incarcerated, a month later, that was in 2015, USAA, who we had all of our automobile and homeowners insurance, contacted me to tell me I could no longer be part of their policy or insuree due to his incarceration. And to make a long story short, you know, how dare I stay with him? How disgusting, the whole thing. So that's a whole nother story. Now, my son, Joshua, who has gone and lobbied and been with Chance and seen you, Janice, since he was 14, is now at Fort Benning in the Army. And he went in October. And during his basic and processing, it was like an entire day of explaining what a sexual assault is and telling them that doesn't matter what your family member did, they will not be allowed on this base, but especially if they are on the registry. So,
well, that's a sobering statement, but I thank you for sharing it with us, Laura. Unfortunately, I'm not surprised. And one way I view this is like the pendulum is swinging. So I'm a Navy veteran myself. I did not stay in the Navy for 20 years. So I'm not a retiree. But I remember even when I was in the military, which is quite a few years ago, you know, there were all kinds of claims being made about sexual abuse. I mean, we're talking about rape, violent rapes. And some people thought they were being swept under the rug. I'm talking about one military member against another military member. We're not even talking about children. We're talking about adults. And over the years, I've watched the military get criticized in the media, by the legislators, Congress, et cetera. And I almost think, though this is my half-baked notion, that the pendulum now has swung too far. Okay. So that now it's like, oh my gosh, we have to do every single thing that we can supposedly to protect, you know, folks who are on the bases. And again, if you drink the Kool-Aid and you think that everybody on the registry is poses a current danger, then maybe that makes sense, but we know better. Okay. So we know that there are a lot of people on the registry. In fact, most people on the registry, in fact, practically every person on the registry today doesn't pose a current danger. Okay. So, and when any government organization, in this case, the military, makes this really broad statement that anybody on a sex offender registry is not going to be able to get access to a base, that is a mistake. And that is a mistake that will be litigated. So I can't promise you when we're going to file the lawsuit. I want to get it done sooner rather than later. I always have an itchy finger when it comes to litigation. It's like, yeah, let's go file a lawsuit. But folks, we really need to get our ducks in a row because there are unfortunately a lot of cases that we have to distinguish our situation from that said, we don't care what your recruiter promised you, but we don't owe you that, whatever it was. So, so just understand, it's not legally, it's not a clear legal matter, and it's not a slam dunk. So we have to find what I call a Rosa Parks plaintiff or two. So in other words, people who have like a perfect situation. Like if they had continued to deny this cancer victim, patient, I guess I should call them, the cancer patient, that I would think that that would be strong enough. We'd go in there, we'd even request immediate relief from the court, you know, of an injunction. But the better news is we didn't have to do that first. He did, in fact, we found somebody who was sympathetic and was willing to go to the base commander and plead his case. And so as of yesterday, he has access to the base and he can get his medical care. So I don't see any more questions or comments about this. Chance, is there anything you want to say before we move on to the next topic?
No. I think we exhausted this, it appears, and I think we should move on in the interest of time.
Okay, thank you. All right, so the next topic we're going to talk about is travel, both domestic and international. And then the last topic is tiered registry. So if you're from California and you really want to hear about tiered registry, please stick in here with us. And I'm just going to admit that something's happened today that we need to apologize for. For some reason, our call meeting today was limited to 100 people. And I've got some emails from some people who wanted to join us and couldn't. I'm not sure why that happened. Our organization is still relatively new at the Zoom technology. And for those of you who are, but it is being recorded and everybody can listen later. So for those who try to get on today and were not able to, we apologize and we will fix the problem before next time. Because I know, Chance, you and I had a webinar, or was it the SORNA regulations? Anyway, we did something. We had 250 people. So why are we being limited to 100 today? I'm not sure. Okay, so let's talk about travel. And Chance, why don't you go ahead and talk about overseas travel because you are the expert.
Well, I'm having I hope everybody can hear me all right. I'm having a little bit of difficulty here with my connection, but Janice, can you hear this clearly?
Yes, I can.
Okay. So anyways, there is a government regulation that's been around for a while since the International Megan's Law legislation, and it has certain requirements for travel. And I think we've exhausted this in many other meetings, but basically there are rules of the road for traveling internationally outside, any territory outside the United States. And they involve two things. One is if you've been convicted of a crime that has anything to do with a minor being defined as a 17-year-old or under, and two, you're registering. If you have those things going for you, then you're subject to notice requirements and also a mark on your passport. And this is precluding you from traveling, throughout the world in a lot of places. Because it's giving notice ahead of time that you're going to arrive at a destination where you might be held back or deported. And so These regulations are very serious, and they really impact those that are on the registry. And by the way, it's not just for those who register and have that type of crime. If you have that type of crime, you still, and you don't register, you still come under the jurisdiction of that law, in that you can still be tracked. And if the tracking shows that you're doing something that they think is irregular, sex trafficking, et cetera, they also have a justification for sending notice. So that means that even people that are off the registry are still subject to that law. What happens with it? It's basically a notice law, and it notifies your country or place of destination that you are coming, and it does it in very unpleasant terms. I might add, though, that there are some nations that are not going along with the program. They're called the Schengen nations, but this is dynamic, and you know, things change all the time. But there's 26 countries, including Italy, which is near and dear to Janice, and she'll say a few words about that. But you know, the bottom line is there are 26 countries, European countries, that are nice places to go. I know we're in a pandemic. I know that not many folks are wanting to travel. And it's really funny because I read an article today that travel has never been more wide open in the world today than now. And it's just, it's a funny phenomenon. But anyways, that's it in a nutshell. Janice?
Yeah, thank you, Chance. So I want to talk briefly about a website that's out there that's not ours. And so it's called the Registrant Travel Action Group. And they're on their website, there's a matrix that will help you learn about where registrants have been turned away, what countries. And folks, you need to understand that you will not be given advance notice in most cases that you can't travel to a country or that you can't enter a country. So what happens to many people, unfortunately, is that they spend a lot of time and the money to get to another country, only to be told when they get to the airport in the other country that they're not going to be allowed to enter the country. And so you get stuck in the airport. You will not get out of the airport. They don't care how many family members, how many friends you have, that you paid for hotel reservations or a villa or any other thing. They're going to just tell you, no, you can't leave the airport. And they're basically going to ship you back to the United States as quickly as possible. So you really don't want that to happen. And that's why Chance and I are here to help you and the Registrant Travel Action Group to try to help you navigate safely so that you can, in fact, travel. Because there are countries, like Chance said, these 26 European countries, including I am of Italian ancestry, and I'm happy to report that at least Italy has a clear mind about this so far, as do Germany, France, and Spain. Those are the four major countries in Europe, the Schengen nations, and they will all allow you to come into their country as a visitor, by the way, not necessarily to move there, but you can come for as a visitor. I think you can with a visa stay up to 90 days. So I know we got some people with their hands up, and Greg Callahan, you are the first person we're calling on. Mr. Callahan, do you have a question? I guess not. Okay, Michael, you are asking.
Hi.
Me.
Hi. Good. So let me seek clarification, because I heard what Chance said, but I wasn't totally clear on the interpretation thereof. So if I were to be removed from my state's registry, I or anyone removed from your state's registry, no longer required to register in your state, but you have an offense against a child, do you still have to give the 21-day notice? And is the unique identifier still attached to your passport?
I would say no to both. So no, you don't have to have a unique identifier. Okay, this is who's required to have a unique identifier. Your offense involved a minor, you're convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. That does mean under the age of 18, 17 and younger. So I know in some states, the crazy thing is the age of consent is 16, but it doesn't make any difference to the federal government. It's basically your offense involves somebody under the age of 18 and you're currently required to register. That who's going to have a unique identifier on their passport. So I've been able to to help a few gentlemen who actually live overseas, whose passports were revoked by our U.S. State Department, even though they lived overseas, because they said, well, you were on a registry, and the law says you're currently required to register. So does that clarify that point?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so, but here's an ambiguity, and Chance and I worry about this all the time. I'm speaking for Chance, maybe I shouldn't. I'm worried about this all the time, is the law says, the International Megan's Law says, anybody who has ever been convicted of a sex offense, that our U.S. government will send a notice to the country where you're traveling. Anybody who's ever been registered or convicted of a sex offense. And that's downright scary. Now, I also know when I argued against the International Megan's Law, shortly after it was passed in federal district court, the U.S. attorney who was, representing the government that day said, even though the law says that, we're not doing that. And you know what? I don't believe her.
Well, they, right? Yeah, and this is the ambiguity, and it is an ambiguity. It's the reasoning of those who are tracking, the federal government who's tracking you. And let's just say the marshals, for instance, who transfer this information back and forth. But let's just say that you are the Department of Homeland Security. Whoever's doing this, if you have a pattern of going to countries that are famous for sex trafficking, let's just say, okay, places like Thailand, is famous for sex trafficking. Or the Philippines, or even Mexico. Okay, if you have a pattern of going to those countries, they're going to notice you, and they're going to send out notice. If the countries that you travel to are fairly innocuous, there's probably no need, but they reserve the right to do that. That's my understanding of what they're really saying there. Now, do they just send out notices for everybody? Well, I don't know. And it is very problematic because it impedes your travel, especially if you worked your way off the registry and deserve to be trusted again and not monitored. You know, what is that? So it's hard to really reason why they would do that, but that is there in that law.
Thank you, Chance. All right, we have a person here, Epic Dave. You had your hand up, sir.
Yes, my question is, I'm really confused about this notice of international travel. Does it mean that you have to give them notice that you're leaving the country to the specific country you're going, or to every other country you're going to go after that? Like, could I go to, I don't know, one of these Schengen countries and then go to the next Schengen country from there while I'm on vacation? Do I have to give them another 21-day notice because I'm going to be going from Germany to Bavaria or something like that, Liechtenstein?
Well, I don't think there's any way for you to do that, actually, Dave.
Yeah, it makes it so complicated. It's so stressful.
Yeah, so I think just to clarify what Dave is talking about is, what if you decide you're going to go visit the country of my ancestry, Italy, and you're having such a good time in Italy, and you meet some people, and they go, hey, we saw this castle in Germany. And we really highly recommend that you go there. And by the way, the food's great. You like sauerkraut, et cetera. And so you go, yeah, I want to go to Germany. But you didn't tell the United States before you went to Italy that you're going to go to Germany as well. There's no way for you to notify the U.S. government. I don't think you have an obligation to do that, okay? But please be careful. Don't get too close to the line. So and one of the ways I mean this is, like, if you already have a ticket to go from Italy to Germany to Japan, well, you have an obligation to say, I'm going from Italy to Germany to Japan, which makes no sense, of course, but to travel that way, but still. It's worth exploring, and I don't want to get any more specific with that unless somebody calls me on the phone, because this meeting is being recorded. So again, there's still actually the biggest question out there is, who has to notify the U.S. government that the traveling overseas? And it's not perfectly clear. So that is a SORNA requirement. And if you live in a non-SORNA state, the question is, do you have to give that 21-day notice? My answer is, Probably not, but I do it anyway, right? So why do I say that? Okay, for one thing, all the manifests from for flights that start in the United States and go overseas, every manifest at this point in time is being looked at by the federal government, and they're identifying anybody who is required to register as a sex offender. And they're going to, then they turn around and notify the country that you're going to travel to. So kind of whether or not you tell them, they're going to know anyway. And the U.S. government, and they're going to send this notice that you don't want to be sent. I understand that. So because then you look at, well, what's the possible penalty here if I was required to give the 21-day notice and I failed to do it? It's you could spend 10 years in federal prison. So I don't know about you, but I don't want to spend any years in federal prison. And the fact is that, you know, Chance and I, as we're giving you information, we're helping you to avoid spending up to 10 years in federal prison. So some of this is a matter of risk, folks, how much risk you're willing to take. Do you want to add anything, Chance, before we move on to Scott?
Yeah, also, some of this is just common sense. If you live in a non-SORNA state like California, and, you know, think of it as international blackjack, the dealer showing an ace and a 10. And most reasonable people would put down an insurance. Well, think about the 21-day notice as insurance. Insurance that when you get back, you won't be the first test case to be looking at 10 years prison or a very hefty fine. And I think that that's a calculus you've got to make. But that's you know, getting insurance and making sure that at least you comply, because you're leaving California, you're entering, you know, federal jurisdiction. So, you know, think about it for a minute. And I think you'll come down on the side of insurance, probably take the conservative route, and give that 21-day notice.
Yeah, thank you, Chance.
You're welcome.
So, and thank you, Scott. Going to move on to Steve now. Steve, you have a question or comment about overseas travel?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Chance? Yes.
Okay. I've been fortunate to be able to travel internationally quite a bit. I've been on a lot of cruises, over 40 cruises with a specific cruise company. And this has been, my offense was 31 years ago. So it's a long time ago, and I'm not on paper anymore, but of course I'm a registrant, and I was notified this past year that a cruise company would not allow me on their cruise ships anymore because they passed a policy in January of 21 that they're not allowing anybody that's a sex offender that's on the registry on their cruise ships.
Well, Scott, I can't say that I'm surprised. I know that there are some cruise lines out there that have policies like that. And I think if you contacted me separately when it's not a recorded meeting, I have some additional information I can share with you.
Okay. I feel like the cruise companies have had a lot of pressure that are based out of Florida, a lot of political pressure put on them, as well as countries, because of this SORNA regulation to give a 21-day notice. All the countries know that a sex offender is being transported by the cruise line into their country. And so it gives the false impression that the cruise industry is actually bringing sex offenders into their country. Supposedly.
If only they worried about COVID germs, right? Okay, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll contact you separately. Thank you, Janice.
Okay. You're welcome. I will tell you, one time I did, weigh in with the Royal Caribbean cruise line. And specifically because a registrant had already paid for his cruise as well as his wife's cruise, already gotten flights to go there, you know, paid for excursions, I think is what they call them, you know, while he was on board the ship. I mean, all these things. And then he was told like only about 10 days before the cruise was to leave the port that, they weren't going to let them on board the ship. And they specifically said, because you're a sex offender, and also we're not going to give you any of your money back. So when that happened, I was able to help the man get his money back, but he was not allowed on the ship. So unfortunately, ships you know, private businesses can, in fact, have their own policies about who they want to do business with. And unfortunately, there are some out there who do not want to have registrants on board. And I think, too, this, again, maybe one another example about the pendulum swinging, because there were, in fact, some sexual assaults on cruise ships. And I think the cruise lines responded differently. And some of them, some people thought that they didn't respond as strongly as other some people would want them to. In other words, keep all the registrants off. And so I think because of that, some of the cruise lines are going, have gone too far. So I'll just leave it at that. So let's talk about domestic travel shortly, and then we'll jump into the tiered registry law, because I know a bunch of Californians are waiting for that. When it comes to traveling domestically, just understand that each state has their own requirements about when a registrant has to register in their state. Every state's different, okay? Rhode Island, 24 hours. I think if Hawaii is 10 days, everything in between, right? And so it's up to you to educate yourself about what the registration requirements are. And why would you do that? Because you want to avoid being convicted of failure to register, right? And so you can be convicted in another state if you don't, if you didn't properly register there. And I'm working with somebody right now. By the way, he's my client and submitting a petition for his removal. Well, what he didn't bother to tell me was he was convicted of failure to register in another state. And so, and he didn't resolve that. So he's got a warrant for his arrest in that state. And I caught him by surprise. Like, oh, I didn't remember that. Maybe they told him, maybe they didn't tell him. But the overall advice is this, is to register in as few states as you can. Because if you think back to the International Megan's Law, who, you know, and the requirement to have a unique identifier on your passport, you're only required to have that unique identifier if you're currently required to register, okay? And unfortunately, there are some states out there, and the two that always pop in my mind are Florida and New York. If you ever register in Florida and New York, they won't take you off. They won't. I mean, that's the beginning and that's the end. And so though I think maybe, and Wolf, I know you're there waiting and perfect timing, because maybe you can address this. I know there's a lawsuit, at least one pending right now about Florida, and somebody who doesn't live in the state any longer or may never have never lived there, but just visited and is trying to get off the Florida registry. But in general, Florida and New York are difficult, if not impossible, to get off the registry. And because of that, this is domestic travel, it might in fact trigger this requirement for you to have a unique identifier added to your passport. So I'm going to unmute you now, Wolf. Please join us. Hi. Yes.
Okay. Here's a question. Suppose on the 21, I know Pennsylvania doesn't require it on the state for the 21 rules. I guess they're ex post facto, but you still have to register, I guess. Who do you register with? One question. Number two is if you leave from Pennsylvania, but is there also a provision in the law? I haven't seen it and I haven't talked to anybody who does. Suppose there's an emergency. Suppose you have a death in the family. You've got to go literally to Italy. What happens then? You still got to wait. I mean, has anybody had any experience with this?
I haven't heard of anybody that has had that experience, but I have a similar concern that you just expressed, which is what if there is in fact an emergency, you need to travel overseas and you have less than 21 days notice. Now in the new SORNA regulations that just came out and became effective on January 7th, there is an impossibility defense. So you could at least make that defense and say after the fact, well, I didn't know that my loved one was, you know, terminally ill or going to be hit by a car, right? Is on their deathbed. And that's at least an affirmative defense. But of course, there's a concern there, which is, are you going to be defending yourself when you're sitting in federal prison?
Yeah. All right. Yeah, because I was just asking that. Yeah. Okay. That's the only question I had. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. All right. So moving on to Scott. Scott, I'm going to unmute you.
Hi. I appreciate it. A quick domestic question. Florida, I just looked just probably 3 days ago because I plan on traveling there, and it said that roughly 5 days, you know, you can register or be there for 5 days and not have to register. However, I just looked again this morning and it said 48 hours. And I was very concerned because Florida being a hot spot for vacations and that sort of thing. I didn't know maybe if there's a website that might have more clarity, or like you said, just research, do your best, and maybe contact a lawyer if need be.
We have on our website, if you go to the on the like toward the top of the website on the homepage, there's a tab that you can click on. It's called legal, and there's two documents you can drop down. I will tell you, if Florida is not 48 hours, our information is not up to date, because I thought it was 3 days. So we have a Floridian here. Floridian?
Yeah, hi. All right. On Florida, you know, I'm located in Florida and we do litigation down here. It's 48 hours. And here's a really weird situation we had. If you're transient, I mean, you're living on the street, basically, you got to report once a month. We've had instances where in one county, Broward County, they said, oh, listen, as long as it's that same month, it's not like a month later, you know, we're okay. So if it's February, you report okay anytime in March. Well, in other counties is if you report it on the 21st and end up the 22nd, the next month, they're going to arrest you for the 1 day delay. We've been winning and they've been throwing it out, but it's 48 hours no matter what, you're down here. So once you get here, 48 hours, and they're very explicit and they're very hard on it.
Yeah. And again, Florida is one of those states where if you, it's almost impossible to get off. Though, I don't know, do you may want to make any comment about that lawsuit?
Well, they have a litigation right now. Actually, I think they got two of them. I don't think they brought them in as a companion case yet. But the litigation is, hey, I went to New York and I'm never going back to Florida. I was there for like 2 weeks for vacation and now you won't get rid of me. Or people have died and they're still on the registration. So right now it's in the middle of litigation. The courts haven't decided it yet.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that update. So, I did want to mention in Florida, there has been a lawsuit in the past. I've been told, I haven't ever read it, that even dead people are on the Florida registry. And by the way, there was just a report put out by the Florida government, state government, and they talked about their registry. And it was fascinating because in the report, they actually admitted that of, I think at least half of the people on their registry don't live in the state. So they're people who came to the state as visitors. They went to Disney, whatever they did. And they registered not really understanding that they were never going to get off the Florida registry. And as I said, New York is just as bad.
Yeah, it's not right. Not right.
So folks, I don't see any more hands. So let's go ahead and move on to the tiered registry law. This is huge, of course, for folks in California. We won't be offended if anybody leaves. The hands are popping up. If you're from another state, though, I will say that if you are from another state, you might be at least intellectually curious about what's going on. So let's just talk about it real briefly, and then we'll take questions and comments. Again, if you have a question or a comment, please raise your hand using the reactions button on the bottom of your screen. So in 2017, which seems so long ago, because it was so long ago, the California legislature finally approved the tiered registry law. Now, our organization had been lobbying for a tiered registry law for 7 years, and the tiered registry law that the legislature passed is not the law that we asked for. So the biggest reason why is because we asked for a law that was based upon risk, and we got one that was based upon conviction. So, and this is huge for people like Frank Lindsay. Okay, Frank Lindsay was convicted in 1979. This man's been on the registry for over 40 years, right? And he doesn't pose a current danger. Yet, he's still required to register because of his conviction offense. Okay, and in the beginning, by the way, California, we had a lifetime registry for practically everybody convicted. It didn't make any difference if you basically relieved yourself on the side of a highway, if you convicted multiple violent rapes, you're on the registry for a lifetime in California. So it's better than that. The tiered registry is better than that, which is lifetime for everybody. And now we have three tiers. And so the lowest tier is tier one. And if you're on tier one, lucky enough to be on tier one, you only have to register for 10 years. Unless a bunch of other things happen. If you're assigned to tier two, you have to register for 20 years. unless, again, certain things happen. Okay, if you're unlucky enough to be assigned to Tier 3, you're required to register for a lifetime, with one exception. I'm not even going to mention it now because it doesn't apply to most people. So what happened, by the way, in this legislative process, and remember, folks, it is like watching sausage be made. And the thing is, you're going to get an imperfect result no matter what. So there was a big political compromise that was made, and that's exactly what it was. The author of the bill, who was the, you know, on the Senate Public Safety Committee, which had primary jurisdiction of this, he had a really difficult decision to make one day. And they said, they being law enforcement, we are going to kill your bill unless you agree to compromises. And he had a hard decision to make. And I'm empathetic and sympathetic and compassionate. And I still think, you know, something's better than nothing. But instead of 90% of the people on our registry being able to petition or eligible to petition, it's closer to maybe 50%. So we lost about 40% of the people. Most of these people, or many of them, were people convicted of a felony child pornography offense. Makes me crazy. So you're telling somebody who looked at a photograph online, right? You're telling somebody that that person is on the same level as somebody who's been convicted of multiple violent rapes. Makes no sense to me, but that was a political compromise. Political compromises don't make sense, okay? Just understand that going in. So many people are like, they're trying to make sense of this thing, and it's not rational. It's not reasonable. So you can't make sense of it. Just understand it was a political compromise, and maybe that will help your brain process this information. So the law was passed in 2017. We had to wait until 2021, 4 years, for it to take effect. And then the most important part of it, the petitioning process, right? So you want to get off the sex offender registry. It requires a petition. None of it is automatic. That process didn't start until July 1 of last year. So Chance and I, as active litigating attorneys, we've only had about 6 months of experience with the tiered registry law here in California. And quite frankly, there's mixed results. You know, I'm happy that I've been able to get 3 people off the registry so far. I haven't been denied any yet, but who knows what's going to happen next, because I have a difficult case. And I don't think I'll mention it right now, but I might before this is over. San Diego, which has the best track record of any place in California, their court has granted 44 petitions have been granted in San Diego. As far as I know, that's the largest number in any county. Sacramento, 4 have been granted. And when I talked to the public defender's office there, they said, no, none of them have been denied yet, because they have, in fact, filed more than 4. One of them was put on hold because of a tolling situation. And I don't need to explain that right now either. But anyway, that's kind of the overview of the tiered registry law as I see it. And Chance, I'm sure you have some things to add.
Oh, just, you know, I'm having done the prior remedy, which is certificates of rehabilitation, and now doing these are going a lot smoother than the certificates. Those were complex and more difficult. There are issues here. I'm happy to say that I've gotten somebody relieved from the registry that was a to-be-determined person, but that's not clear across all jurisdictions. That happens to be very jurisdictional. Most people that are going to be successful are going to have a tiered designation, and they're going to have current proof of registration. And this is a different form than just your regular registration form, but it has to be attached to your petition. And I know there are issues with getting them, and I know that there are all kinds of other issues involved. And so I don't want to get into the complexity of it, just to say that I think that the system is a little bit more smoother, but it's jurisdictional, and that there's a lot of obstacles out there, because I do these across the state, and every jurisdiction is different. So with that in mind, I'm ready to take questions if you are.
I am. And Steve, you have your hand up, so I'm going to ask you to unmute. And Steve, I don't know if this is because, if your hand is up because of an old issue. I know your hand was up then. So if you don't have a question on this issue, Steve, I would appreciate if you could take your hand down. Epic Dave. Same situation for you, sir. I don't know if you really have a question about this.
I do have a question.
Fabulous.
My question is basically that if I know it's 20 for my situation, it's a 20, I think it's 25 years because I'm at level two to get off the registry at this point. However, in my case, I ended up I was forced into taking a really bad deal, which other people in my same situation would only get a few years. So I ended up doing more time, which makes the whole thing the starting point of when they start counting is when I get released. But I technically did more time than I should have, in my opinion. Is there a way to get that adjusted in the courts?
I think a criminal defense attorney, Chance Arborstein, needs to answer that question.
Yeah, without going into detail, I would just say, give me a call. I wouldn't want to discuss these things on.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
All right, we've got David here waiting patiently for his third comment. David, are you there?
Yeah, there we go.
There you are.
Fantastic. Is it my third comment? Oh, this is my third comment. Wow, okay. I do have a comment, and that is the craziness of our California tiered registry. The fact that a 288C is, I believe, on the highest level, tier three.
Yes.
As well as the illegal images being on tier three. And yet, if you actually had a physical offense, with someone under 14, that's on tier two. It's just bizarre. So anyway, my question is, can you tell me what's going on as far as litigation regarding the 288C and tier three?
Absolutely. So David is absolutely right. We have filed a lawsuit in California basically challenging the tier assignment for people who in fact were convicted of 288C, which is lewd or lascivious acts with someone who's 14 or 15 years old. So our legal claim is in fact equal protection. And what we mean by that is that the folks convicted of the same, doing the exact same thing, but with a younger victim is assigned to tier two, yet somebody with an older victim, again, the same acts, is on tier three. So that doesn't pass my logic test. I hope it doesn't pass yours either. And so we challenged it in court. Our trial court judge granted a demurrer, which is like a motion to dismiss the case. And I think the reason that she did that was she was afraid. This is one of those decisions that, you know, could possibly be unpopular. And oh, who knows, maybe somebody wouldn't vote to reelect her. I guess that might be the way that she's thinking. And so she'd rather have an appellate court make the decision rather than her. So anyway, that's where we are. We have, in fact, filed a notice to appeal the case, and we're, you know, going through that process. But there are many other situations that we want to challenge as well. We'd like to win this first one before we go to the next one. And certainly the biggest one, the biggest group of people, if is in fact, people convicted of possessing child pornography and were convicted of a felony. We do have some people in our state who were convicted of a misdemeanor offense, a CP offense, and I'm happy to say they're on tier one. But if in fact you're unlucky enough to have been convicted of a felony that could not or was not reduced to a misdemeanor, then you're going to be on tier three, the highest tier. And so we've had somebody join us here, Jay, asking you to unmute, sir.
Morning, Janice. Morning, Chance. Morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I want to get a question in real quick. There's a laudably popular yet unpopular idea out there amongst the medical community that people who have these types of convictions or registrants have some type of a mental health issue or something of that respect. What do y'all think is the probability or maybe possibility or laudability of people who are registrants having coverage and protection under the medical acts on the federal level as far as protection for discrimination against mental health issues.
So, Jay, I think you asked this question earlier, therefore I'm going to mute you. Please don't ask that question again. We are talking here about the tiered registry, folks, and if you could keep your comments or your questions to tiered registry, I'd appreciate it, because we have limited time. So let me talk real briefly about a case that I'm working on, because I guess it was to be expected, but it's still, it's going to be a difficult case. So I have a client who was convicted of Penal Code Section 288A, lewd and lascivious acts with somebody under the age of 14. And the tiered registry law clearly says tier two, and he got a tier two assignment letter. And guess what? The DA's office is objecting to his petition. Oh, and I forgot to say, he's been on the registry for 26 years. It's been 26 years since he was released from custody. He's got a completely blank criminal history after his conviction. And yet the DA's office is objecting. So I'm glad Chance hasn't had this experience yet, but this is mine. And so we have a hearing now scheduled in March. And it's going to be difficult because you're like proving a negative. I don't pose a current danger to society. How do you prove somebody doesn't pose a current danger to society? Now, I ask him, and he's getting a psychological evaluation, including a static 99 score and other things, letters of support and such. It's really for those of you who might have gotten a certificate of rehabilitation. I am viewing it as very similar, and it's an evidentiary hearing. He's going to be represented by an attorney. That would be me. And folks, if you are in fact going through the petitioning process, and if in fact the DA objects to your petition, and why, this is the wording from the petition, because community safety would be significantly enhanced if this man was required to continue registration. And I will tell you that there are no legal definitions to the words community safety, though it's pretty close to public safety. And so I can probably make an argument there, but what in the heck does significantly enhance mean? So lick your finger, hold it up to the wind. Maybe you can figure that out. Maybe the judge will figure that out. But, you know, if you think about the big picture here too, the judge who's going to make this decision and makes all these decisions about whether or not to grant a petition, they're appointed to their job originally, but after that, they're up for re-election. And so many of them do not want to make a decision that they think could adversely affect their re-election. I'm sorry, but that's what most of these judges care about. I think it's a travesty of justice myself, but oh well, it is what it is. And so as Chance knows very well too, we have to deal with the reality of the situation and reality. And so what we do then in situations like this, and the same with certain, let me tell you about this person and how he's being, you know, been a law-abiding citizen for 26 years in this particular case, or whatever else other arguments that we have to make. And then we have to produce evidence to show this. And I mean, the weird thing is that I think you look at the person's rap sheet, right? And if they haven't committed a crime in 26 years, that means to me they're a law-abiding citizen. But obviously some DAs anyway, think differently. So Chance, why don't you add to that if you would?
Well, you know, the thing about this is, you know, you're kind of shooting in the dark sometimes. It's new law. There is a factor tree. So when a prosecutor says that the, you know, community safety of the community would be enhanced if this person remains on the registry, what they're saying is the person still needs to be monitored for what reason, we don't know. It's just a general statement. So you've got a factor tree. One of the factors is facts and circumstances of the case. And that's where things can get sticky. Okay, because you can pretty much deal with almost every other factor, but that's something that's just engraved in stone. And, you know, what are you going to do? Go back and relitigate the case. So this is all new. And so, you know, the road is being paved, it's being pioneered. And, you know, so all I can say is that we'll get there when we get there. We'll know better when we do these things. I have a case almost approximately the same as Janice's. Well, I had a case. It's my client actually went to prison for a while and was registering probably an equal amount of time. Same charge, and was removed from the registry in a jurisdiction that actually was, you know, very favorable. So it's hard to say what will happen and where it will happen. And it's hard to say what's going to happen once you get into that hearing where, you know, but, you know, the first initial assessment is, well, does this person pose a risk? And, you know, that leads you into getting a forensic expert and having them conclude otherwise, if that's the case. And so, again, it's pioneering. And we're moving forward. We're not going backwards. So it's going to be an interesting year.
Yes, it is. And I think we'll talk about the 12-month period from July 1 of last year to June 30th of this year. So we've got a hand up here, Ken. I think you want to have you have a question or comment? You're okay, Ken. You need to unmute yourself again. You're unmuted for a minute. Yeah, we can't hear you, Ken, unfortunately. Oh, no.
Looks like he can't unmute there.
He was unmuted for just a minute. Let's give him another minute here. Oh, Ken? No. We can't hear you, I'm sorry. Okay. So there aren't any other people with questions or comments. So I think that it's time to wrap up this meeting. Again, I want to apologize to people who tried to get into the meeting and were not able to. So you all are the lucky ones. You got into the meeting. We'll figure out what the technical flaw was because we've had bigger meetings than this. Okay, Ken, let's try one more time. No. Oh, there, Ken.
Yeah, it said it continued to say host has to unmute you. I'm sorry. Anyhow, I'm a California convicted felon, but not in California now. Would the tier allow those out of state to be able to come back into state and get off the registry?
I think the answer is yes, but you need to be careful. Okay, so I want to give you a couple of different scenarios. If you come back to the into California and you register in California, and by the way, you can be registered in more than one state, okay, then you come here and you register, and then you petition for removal and your petition's granted. So all these positive things happen, right? The question is, if you decide to move back to that state that you came from, I don't know if that state would require you to register or not. So I'm actually working with a couple of people right now who were convicted in California, moved out of state. One of them has already moved back to California, is now registered in California, will petition in California, but he's not sure the state, and he's registered in two states lawfully. In fact, he has to be registered in two states. And the question is, will the state that second state allow or require him to register or not? And folks, I strongly recommend that you talk to an attorney in that state. So even though you're relieved from registration in California, that may not help you in other states, I guess is my bottom line. You have to talk to an attorney who knows what they're talking about before you do that. And by the way, if you were convicted in California and you moved to another state, guess what? You're taken off the California registry. We're not Florida or New York. It's just automatic. You leave the state permanently, you're off the registry. So, but what Ken brought up is, well, what if, and the only value would be is if you come back to California, you get off the California registry, then you can go to some states and say, hey, I'm not required to register in my count or my state of conviction. And therefore I don't have to register in your state. That only works in some states. It does not work in all states. So be very careful. Yanina, you've been asking or waiting to speak?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, everybody. I am a family member And let's see, I've been hearing and listening, and it's overwhelming information. I'm new to this to this territory, and I am overwhelmed by all this information. And I just wanted to address to what Janice has said earlier, you know, and regarding my son's case, I'm not gonna go in details, but it would be nice, you know, if I had attorneys for my son or myself advocating on my son's behalf, in how positively he will be contributing to the raising of his child if he is not mandated to register on the 296 offender, you know, because that will be like an obstacle. That registration for him will be an obstacle in financially contributing to his child. And instead, that will become a burden to society and to the government here in California. That was my comment. My question is, because I didn't quite understand, tier one, tier two, and tier three, I have here my notes that's 10 years, 20 years, lifetime. But my question exactly is, tier one, who exactly goes for tier one? What kind of count is that, like as far as age, tier two and tier three? And then my other question is, if my son was given two deals, okay, right now my son is out on bail and then they wanted to take him back in, but apparently he went through he paid for a psychological evaluation and now he's out on working release. And then he has to go back to court in March on two offers, which are like, oh my God, these offers are still asphyxiating, you know? And I was wondering if I can talk to Chance or Janice, or maybe my son can talk to either one of you. And that's it, thank you.
You're welcome. I think that's a case for Chance to take. He's a criminal defense attorney. I'm not a criminal defense attorney. So Chance Oberstein is his last name. Yanina, if you put your contact information in the chat section, then Mr. Oberstein can contact you that way, okay? And to clarify, people, I just want you to know, even though I get involved in these issues, including the tiered registry, I'm not a criminal defense attorney. I'm a civil attorney. I file civil rights lawsuits. But the thing about the tiered registry is it's kind of quasi-criminal, quasi-civil. And because, in fact, I helped lobby for it for 7 years, I know quite a bit about it. Okay, Daniel, I'm going to call on you next, sir. You're the last person with his hand up.
Thank you, Janice. My question is, my conviction in 2009 was for two separate cases. They were tried concurrently, and I served concurrently. And I was reading on the website about the tier two and tier three. Tier three says that it has to be a separate brought on a separate conviction. Now, if they were tried, the two victims and the two cases were tried concurrently, and I served concurrent sentences, is that still considered tier two, or would it be bumped to tier three?
Well, Daniel, I think the best way for you to find that out is get a tier assignment letter. Do you have a tier assignment letter?
I do not, and I heard your information, and I do need to speak with my registering agent next month. Yeah.
Okay. So let me. So I'm not going to give you a direct answer to your question. If you would like Mr. Oberstein to contact you, please put your contact information in the chat section of this thing. If you're not comfortable doing that, you can call the organization. Our phone number is 818-305-5984. Again, Axol's phone number is 818-305-5984. Or if you are comfortable, just go ahead and put your name and contact information in the chat section and Mr. Oberstein can contact you. But I think you raised a really good issue that is deserving of a few minutes here. It has to do with tier assignment letters. So folks, you have to go get your own tier assignment letter. It's not going to be sent to you, okay? and I'm going to say, make a sarcastic statement now. It would just be too simple for the California Department of Justice to send mail you a letter, right? That's what should happen here, but it's not what happened. And I actually had California DOJ tell me to my face that they didn't have enough money to mail you a letter. And I cried bullshit. First time I've sworn in this meeting. That's pretty good for me. Okay, but it is past noon. Hey, I can swear now. Anyway, it's ridiculous. The state government is saying they can't mail a letter to over 100,000 people. I mean, come on. Our state government is the fifth largest economy in the whole world, and you can't afford to mail a letter to registrants. That's just a lie. So anyway, but they're refusing to do it. Let's put it that way. And so instead, if you're on the registry and you want to know what your tier assignment is, you need to go to your registration office and ask very kindly and politely, please ask for your tier assignment letter. Your tier assignment letter should be in a government-only database. It's called CSAR, which stands for the California Sex Offender and Arson Registry, CSAR database. Chance and I, as private attorneys, we do not get access to that database. I wish I did have access to it for your benefit. We don't. So you have to go to a government official, in this case, your registration office, and ask for your assignment letter. Now, some law offices are kind enough to say, we don't want you to come into the office because of COVID or any other reason. So I'll tell you what, we're going to send you, we, the registration office, are going to send you your tier assignment letter, and they might do it by email. They may do it by snail mail, but your tier assignment letter should be in the CSAR database. All they have to do is click on your name, for goodness sake, and then they can print out the letter and hand it to you, or mail it to you, or email it to you. A couple of offices have been very kind and emailed letters so people don't have to go in. But it's up to you to go get your own tier assignment letter, because Chance and I, we can make very good educated guesses about your tier assignment, but what we say is not the ultimate decision. What California DOJ says is probably the ultimate decision. And I say it that way because both Chance and I have, in fact, requested tier reductions for a couple of people, and they've been granted. It's the exception rather than the rule, folks. So please, if you have a tier three assignment, don't run to Chance or I and say, hey, I think I belong with tier one. I mean, we'll talk to you about it, but it's quite possible that the tiered registry law has a different opinion. And if the tiered registry law has a different opinion, it's like tugging on Superman's cape. It's not worth it. Okay. But there are some times where, guess what? The California Department of Justice has made some mistakes. And in those situations, Chance and I have brought it up to the California Department of Justice. And at least in a couple of instances, we've gotten a person's assignment changed from tier three, by the way, all the way down to tier one. So that's the crazy thing. It's not like you're going to go from tier three to tier two. It's from tier three down to tier one. So it's worth doing it. It's worth consulting with Chance or I to see if that might be possible. But we certainly don't always get that the same result. Okay, now there are no hands up. So I'm going to wrap it up here. Welcome to today's meeting. We're so glad that you were here. We've covered a lot of ground in one meeting. We've been here for about 2.5 hours, and you've been good listeners for 2.5 hours. And if you have any other questions about this, you can listen again to this because it has been recorded. There will be a link to this recording on the AXL website. So let me remind you of our website address, www.4conso.org. So all4conso.org. You'll see a link to this recording. It's a wonderful and easy way to donate a few dollars to the organization, or $1 million to the organization. Just please use the donate button. So I think that's it for me. Chance, do you have any last words here?
Just thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. We've had a great meeting. Look forward to doing this again. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Take good care. Bye-bye.